The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Mompós, Bolívar, 6 hours south from Cartagena on the Caribbean coast. And this is episode 336 of the Columbia Calling podcast. And this week's very special guest is Brian Johnston, originally from Toronto, but now doing amazing stuff, socially aware classes and cooking classes and finance classes in the city of Medellin, it seems. That Medellin has captured his heart and his imagination. So we'll be talking to him in segment 3 about his project there in Medellin and the reality of what's going on in Medellin at this moment. If you haven't heard, and it'd be very unusual for you to not have heard, but the Colombian, the intelligent isolation put in place by the Colombian government has been extended to the end of August. And yes, so that means we're under lockdown again and continued until the end of August. So my heart goes out to the people out there in total isolation in rural Colombia who cannot get out and about. Here in Mompós, for example, everything, all businesses have to close by 1 o'clock and everyone must be off the streets. We have what is known as a pico y cédula. So depending on the number which your cédula ends in, refers and makes a reference to the day that you can go out each week. And so I have 1 day a week, and I believe it's Thursday, that I can go out and do any essential business that I need to do, such as banking or shopping or the like. So tough times here in Colombia, as the quarantine, I believe, is the longest now anywhere in the world. I will leave you in the capable hands of Emily Hart for this week's news segment, and then we'll be back on this episode 336 with Brian Johnston. Thank you again for listening, and don't go away.
I'm Emily Hart, and this is the news for Columbia Calling for the week of August 3rd, 2020. Columbia has now surpassed 10,000 COVID-19 deaths, with recorded cases at over 300,000. Intensive care units are at around 90% capacity in Bogotá, Cali, and Medellín. Lockdowns are being partially reimposed across the country. Bogotá has been hardest hit and is entering the projected peak weeks of the pandemic, with its health system already on the verge of collapse. The majority of COVID deaths in Bogotá are not even passing through an intensive care unit before death. Funeral services are also in crisis in the capital. Refrigeration containers have had to be given to cemeteries, which cannot keep up with the cremation of the deceased. President Iván Duque has laid out his prioritization strategy for rolling out a potential vaccine in Colombia, assuring that a vaccine would first be given to people over 60 and to those with comorbidities, for example, hypertension, diabetes, and obesity. Medical personnel would also be prioritised. The Transport Minister has announced the normalisation of flights for tourism and visitors for November. This week, Colombia's vice president tried to sue a think tank and then changed her mind. Marta Lucia Ramírez filed criminal charges against crime analyst Jeremy McDermott for revealing evidence of business links between her husband and a senior drug trafficker. The criminal defamation case against McDermott accused him of damaging the moral integrity, good name, dignity and honour of the vice president in his article. After public outcry and pressure from international group the Committee to Protect Journalists, Ramírez dropped the charges. In more legal news, two historic cases are moving forward this week. Colombia's Supreme Court is now deliberating whether to file criminal charges against former President Álvaro Uribe, still a senator and leader of the hard-right ruling party, the Centro Democrático. The potential charges relate to the attempted bribery of witnesses to support accusations against opposition senator Iván Cepeda. The court are also deliberating whether or not to jail the former president on those charges. In 2012, Uribe accused Cepeda of fabricating evidence to tie him to right-wing paramilitary groups, but it was one of Uribe's own witnesses who admitted he had received bribes from Uribe's lawyer. The trial of Uribe's lawyer, Diego Cadena, is, as of last week, underway. He is being prosecuted for bribery and procedural fraud. It has been revealed that over half of all reported killings of environmental and land defenders in 2019 occurred in just two countries, the Philippines and Colombia. 30% of the world's documented killings of this type of human rights defender took place in Colombia, a 150% rise on 2018, according to NGO Global Witness. Over a third of all killings of Colombian land and environmental rights defenders took place in the Cauca. Indigenous groups were particularly at risk, accounting for half the documented killings, despite making up only 4.4% of the population. It's estimated that 89% of murders of human rights defenders do not end in conviction. That was the week's news bulletin. Now back to Columbia Calling with Richard McColl.
And we're back. This is segment three of the Columbia Calling podcast, episode 336. As I told you already, I'm in Mompos Bolivar, 6 hours south of Cartagena, along the banks of the Magdalena River in the sweltering lowlands of this part of the country. And my very special guest this week is, well, originally from Toronto, Brian Johnston, but he's in Medellin on the line from over there. And we're going to talk a little bit about, well, who is Brian and his projects, the Via Cocina food train that he's been doing, which really more than I think I would say, more than being just a cooking kind of charity or a cooking social project, it really embraces further aspects of the whole chain of what needs to be done in order to help people of low income maybe find a creative let's say outlet for possibilities to later earn money. So, well, we're going to talk about that better with Brian. So, Brian, welcome on Columbia Calling.
Thanks, Richard. I appreciate having me.
No, it's a real pleasure to have you there. And of course, we met a few weeks ago online, virtually, as everything is right now, on a webinar that was put together in Pro Columbia and others and Colombian Journeys and so on. So we have many contacts and friends in common, but we haven't met in person. At some point we will, at some point in the future. But I think my my listeners out there around the world will be like, we'll want to know exactly, what is the situation right now in Medellin, I mean, that we're living in?
Well, I mean, it's, I guess, for most of the world right now, some parts are starting to open slowly. Here, it's a little bit different, I would say, where things were, as you know, in most of Colombia, everything was pretty much shut down right from the beginning. And the cases were extremely low of COVID in the country. And now as they started kind of after being 2 months in complete isolation, they start opening things up. And cases have just been kind of exploding. It's a new hotspot, actually, Medellin, next to, I guess, in the coast, Barranquilla and Bogota, where one of the spots that are getting higher and higher concentrations of new cases, including the mayor just announced yesterday that he now has COVID as well. So it's back to being locked indoors for everybody. You can go out maybe once a week to buy essential ingredients, go to the bank if you need to go to the bank, and that's about it. They've got a 4x3 situation here where they're basically allowing shops to be open 4 days a week, and then Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and on long weekends, 4 days, everything is completely closed down, including supermarkets and everything. You're not allowed to go out for anything other than to walk a dog for about 20 minutes. So dogs are getting the most benefits out of this situation, I would say, out of everyone that they're masters at home all day and allowed to go outside and walk at least and get some fresh air.
So your passport to getting outside is having a dog.
Exactly. I don't know how the sales are going right now of dogs, but I can imagine people are kind of anxious to get outside and get some air. They may just be looking at that as an excuse to get outside for 20 minutes a day.
Oh boy, it sounds hard. And here, equally so, I've mentioned to listeners that we're we're allowed one day out a week here in this small town. And it's a curfew from 1 p.m. each day as well. I mean, all businesses have to shut at 1 p.m. You see, it's a small town, and we have but four ICU or five ICU beds. And so the last time I checked, our figures are up to 18. Only, I mean, 18. It's nothing like Medellin, nothing like Bogota or Barranquilla. But if we only have four or five, you know, intensive care beds, 18 people who've got the virus, that's a serious issue. We've had one death. That, you know, there's next to no healthcare. I mean, this was one of the big considerations when we came out here with my family. It was like, you know, we're going to have more space. We're going to have more help. Because, of course, I've got two children, and we'll have more sort of certain degree of liberty, which we weren't getting in Bogota. You know, we'd done more than 105 days in our apartment. And my five-year-old, he didn't know it, but he was going crazy. You know, he didn't know it. It was just bad behavior on his part. And out here, things have improved. But it's hard. I mean... I don't know. I mean, obviously your project, the Via Corsina food train, is completely halted, like everything else. And so, what are you doing at this point in time to occupy yourself?
Yeah, I mean, basically, the only thing one can do to kind of stay sane is here. You probably know with your house what it's like to be renovating. It's not something that happens overnight. So the benefit of having some months of no other businesses happening is the ability to kind of get stuff done around the house that was outstanding, administrative stuff that was outstanding for months or even years. So that's basically all we can do, is kind of finish stuff in the house, try and get the spaces ready so that once we are able to open again, we're more 100% operational, whereas before we weren't able to have all of our services available just because we didn't have the spaces ready. But then again, it's a challenge because I can do what I can with my hands or with helpers, people that I know. I can call them and have them come over and get stuff done. But to get tradespeople working as well, they're not able to work a lot of the time, or they've got so much work that they're way behind as far as getting things done. So everything is a challenge, but that helps, as well as having gardens around the house that grow stuff, and they do a lot better now without all the traffic and dust and stuff in the house. So that's kind of a nice thing to have, be able to eat some organic food. But yeah, that's about it. Aside from that, it's like make long checklists, try to check stuff off and make sure you're getting stuff done, being somewhat productive every day so you don't go insane, spend too much time on the internet surfing the same information over and over again. As I'm sure a lot of people are.
That's the truth, isn't it? I mean, I just keep going down rabbit holes on coronavirus, and but I do exactly. tend to steer clear of what end up looking like conspiracy theories and mad rants. But I mean, if my internet went down, I don't know what we'd do.
Yeah, I mean, I actually, in the project here, I don't have Wi-Fi in the house or internet, because I wanted to limit my internet space. So like other aspects of the project in the future, more creative outlets with painting and drawing. Like I studied fine arts as well, so I'm looking to hopefully start in the next month or as soon as I can get access to materials to do some paintings for the walls and stuff, like big paintings, so that I can get that stuff out of the way as well. Well, we've got some time to be creative, and not having internet gives me that time to kind of focus on creative stuff.
It's true. It's true. I have to say, creatively, my email inbox is down to one email. I feel like I've actually, you know, achieved something. So tell us a little bit. I mean, it's great that you should be, you know, you've got this moment to sort of update and do essential work on the house and the installations. In one of my hotels, we're knocking out a couple of bathrooms to redo them. I guess it's been 10 years. Hard work, hard things to do at this moment in time. But there are so many people in this small town without work. The informal labor market is huge, that it really wasn't hard to find some of our old workers to come back in. And I think this is really where we come in for Via Cocina Food Train. The idea, and you left the corporate world age 25, and you've traveled to scores of countries, and you've settled in Medellin, and your idea is to provide, I think, people of lower income, you know, more opportunity. Tell us a little bit about the Via Cocina Food Train.
Yeah, so basically, when I traveled around the world, I was working since 2003 in international development with different NGOs in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and moved around to about 70 different countries. I took the time as well to learn to cook. Whether I was working in IT or project management or whatever it was, I still connected with the local communities and learned from a lot of times from mothers, grandmothers, and homes how to do the traditional local food. If it was a country where they had a tradition of gastronomy, then I went to restaurants, I went to cooking schools, and I learned how to do the traditional restaurant or gastronomy as well that they had there in those countries. And I collected all those stories, all of those recipes. And a lot of them, no matter what part of the world we're in, there's certain ingredients that are kind of special to different regions. But the basics, tomatoes, onions, garlic, ginger, potatoes, you know, meats, fishes, rice. A lot of this stuff you can find all over the world. And Medellin is just rich in all types of fruits and vegetables, affordable meats. And so the idea is to be able to take all that knowledge that I accumulated from people that were generous enough to share it with me and move to kind of pass that on to people and give them not just the recipes, but cooking techniques. Here, there's not really a culture of healthy eating, of doing things differently with the ingredients that are available. A lot of people go to the supermarket and they've got all tons of different types of vegetables and fruits there, but they'll do one thing with it or they won't even touch it because they don't know what it is. And so just giving people kind of exposure to what you can do with those things and then helping them do something different with it is kind of the focus. And, you know, when I looked at the different projects I worked on around the world and the way that different NGOs interact with different communities, I kind of saw how a lot of times people are stressed or the organizations are really focused on all these quantitative measures and indicators and how we can make sure that we continue getting funding for the project. And a lot of times it's more focused on the paperwork than on the actual impact in the community. And so I was more focused on not worrying about having thousands or hundreds of people coming through. If I work with 5 people or 500 people in a year, as long as they're all motivated, that's what keeps me going. I'm not looking to be funded by big organizations and have the pressure of certain types of outputs that they want to see. And I didn't want to work as well at the same time. The way that a lot of organizations that are working with low-income communities and food, in one way or another, they train them so they've got the skills to work, but then the end result is going out and working for minimum wage in some other organization's kitchen or business's kitchen where they're going to not necessarily be exploited, but to an extent, working in a kitchen is slave work, whether you're the owner, whether you're an employee. And I didn't really want to help people go work long, long hours and not have a quality of life for minimum wage, which is extremely low in Colombia. Instead, I want to teach them business skills, other types of skills that kind of complement cooking and allow them to kind of create their own life objectives by sitting down with them, having them define them, looking at their actual existing situation financially, helping them kind of understand how much is coming in, how much is going out of their house by going to their house and looking at their actual bills instead of talking in theory. And then they can figure out where they're kind of falling short or where they're making ends meet and what they'd want to get out of a business in the short and long term for their family, for them, for their time, not necessarily working 10 hours a day or 12 hours a day, instead maybe working 3-4 times a week for 5-6 hours in strategic moments when people have money and when they want to buy stuff and you can make the same amount of money and have a lot more time for your family and other interests that you have. So it's kind of, as you said, it's just the idea of kind of quality of life, being more efficient with one's goals and with their time and allowing them that, you know, Colombians, they love to appreciate and take advantage of the time they have celebrating with fun with friends, which is obviously probably one of the biggest challenge right now psychologically for a lot of people. Just they're used to being extremely social, but having a kind of a plan that allows you to make money and be social at the same time is kind of the idea of the project, so they can continue to enjoy their time but have a means of doing it that sustains their family at the same time.
Definitely. And I think that obviously you've approached this in I would say almost a novel, from a novel direction. You know, this is small business management. It's not just cooking classes. People aren't just learning how to say, let's say, cook Lebanese food or something exotic. You know, you've got the idea that they're going to cook healthy food and also manage their finances. So this is pretty complete. I would say that, as you say, there are these charities and there are these foundations which might teach cooking, but then people will end up in a certain degree, opening inverted commas there, slave labor in a restaurant. But you've got them, you know, managing finance, managing small business. But in order to get this background and in order to get this kind of communication and ideas across to the people who come in, and we'll speak about the people. I'd love to hear about some of the people who sign up. Do you sit down and hear the hopes and hear the expectations, listen to what the people have to say to you before you design a program for them?
Yeah, definitely. The program, it's personalized to each person. It's kind of just a general idea of what are the different components that we have available, but it's not like a school. We're going to come in and sit down and have 15 people sitting there studying theory and leaving with a piece of paper that says they got a certificate in small business management or finances or cooking or whatever else. It's really personalized to each person. And so that's why it's really important that when somebody comes in and they want to be part of the mentoring program and start their own small business, it's one-on-one. We sit down, we have a first interview here in the project space, where they kind of tell me where they're coming from, what they're looking for in the future, what their goals are, what challenges they've had. And then from there, we go forward and we have a second meeting where I go and meet them in their space, or maybe that might be a third meeting, depending on whether or not through the first meeting we decide that they need to define some more information and come back. But really all of that happens very spontaneously by just listening, understanding, and responding, and then creating a plan with them that works for them. It's not where I'm going to say, okay, we're going to do A, B, and C. No, we're going to sit down. And A is obviously going to be listening. And then from there, we kind of develop the project based on their knowledge, their needs, their availability. Some people, they're going to say, I can only come once a week to learn from you. Other people, they're going to say, okay, I've got 4 days a week where I have time. So all of these factors make a difference in how we work with them and what we have available for them. Some people, they've got their own space and they just want to refine what they've already got going. Maybe they don't understand whether they're making money or losing money with the product that they're selling, and we need to go and do a food cost and then kind of refine what they're doing so that it is profitable. Others, they don't have any space to work, and that's why we've got spaces in the project where they'll be able to come and use those spaces, the food carts that we have available, and sell directly to the public while they're learning. Other people, maybe they don't want to do a food business in that sense. They want to work in tourism, and they participate in the activities we do with tourism to help sustain the project. Others, they want to give courses. I've got people that I'm teaching them how to actually train people so that they can give classes in our spaces with our equipment that complement what we do. And then they're working directly with tourism if they can speak multiple languages, or they're working with the local community with classes that kind of complement the other classes that we give to the community. Because one thing is the project with mentoring. Another thing is we've got classes. When I started the project out, the whole pilot project was based on mentoring and small business. But a lot of people just started, once I was on television a few times and in the radio and on the news, people started ringing the doorbell saying, you know, I saw your project. I'm really interested in learning to cook with you and doing things healthier, but I don't want to start a business. I just want to cook healthy for my family. And so we started providing community classes as well, once, usually two or three classes that are different a month that repeat two or three times each month. And we've done about 25 different classes, themes already. We've got people that haven't missed a class that they want to come and learn to cook all different types of stuff for their families, just to eat healthier at home. They send photos, they create groups where all of them are connected, and they try and program their classes so that they all come at the same time, the same day. There's lots of different ways that people are participating and learning and sharing. And my most important aspect of what I'm doing is to be flexible, to be patient, and to try to find ways to work with anybody that really is motivated and wants to learn and do something different.
Amazing. And how many people would you say, I mean, when did you exactly set this up, and how many people have passed through your doors?
Well, I set it up in 2012. I came here a year before I started the project, when I was still working with Oxfam in El Salvador and Honduras. Mm. I came to do kind of a little bit of a diagnostic for a month to see if it was somewhere I'd like to work and start the project, because I've heard good things about Colombia Medellin from friends that had traveled here. And then I had to go back and finish my contract, go back to Canada, get some stuff in order, start doing some crowdfunding to try and getting some funds to get started. And I landed in Colombia again to kind of restart the project in 2013, the end of 2013. So it's been close to 7 years now that I'm in and out of the country between here and Canada. And during all that time, I mean, on my list of clients that I have now, I have maybe people that are learning. I've got maybe about 200, 250 people on the list, on the current list. I've had people that have come to eat and to participate and just to enjoy healthy food at affordable prices. Thousands of people on the list of people that have tasted the food and come and regularly eating here as well. And then, you know, for the mentoring side of it, we had in the pilot project, we had about 10 people. And then we've got people. The thing is, it's not as simple as saying, okay, we've had X number of people that have come in and out. Because as I said, it's not a school where you're going to come, sit X number of hours and get your certificate. When you're working with vulnerable people, you know, there's a lot of times where somebody wants to come and learn, but they know if they come here while they're learning, they're going to be having a meal. They're going to be learning, but they've got a family back home. If somebody like yourself has a job to do and they can go out and make money for a day and feed their family, obviously they're not going to be coming here. They're going to go do that. So I have to be really flexible. A lot of times it's an iterative approach where you've got somebody that's come, they disappear for a month, they come back. So you kind of take two steps forward, three steps back, two steps forward, one step back, three steps forward, kind of go back and forth to remind them of what they've already learned, and slowly teach them new things and allow them to move forward until they're in a space where they're able to be more balanced as far as earning money, whether it's doing stuff with us or in another space, and learning and supporting their family. So it's a lot of patience, and it's not just one of the big reasons that, like, as I said, to not work with people that are pressuring to have certain things done by certain dates, because that's not the way things work in this country. Mm-hmm. For a lot of people, it's a lot of back and forth struggles, and you got to definitely not get frustrated, not kind of write people off and just kind of give them the opportunity to come and go.
Well, I think after so many years around the world, you've certainly developed and you will have learned patience, definitely, I think. And so long in Latin America, you just sort of sometimes like, all right, that's the way it is. You know, it's not resignation, it's just acceptance of a culture. And in order to do that, you know, you need to get into the flow here for that. It's pretty amazing. And so how are you funded? You said earlier that you got some crowdfunding together, but how do you keep this project afloat?
Yeah, so the crowdfunding was, unfortunately, I was about 2 months too early in crowdfunding, because this was 2013. A lot of people didn't know what crowdfunding was yet. And when I did mine, I think I got, I don't remember how many hundreds of donations I got, but I sent it out to everybody I knew. They sent it out to their friends and their friends. And I had people donating, whether it was $1 or $3 or $10, from small little villages in Africa, in Argentina, in Peru, people that I had met and created relationships with during my volunteer work around the world. They really wanted to support it any way they could, which is extremely touching because these are people that don't really have means of giving more than those $2 or $3, which could be a day's or 2 days' salary and food for the whole family. So for me, that was extremely valuable. And in the end, I had maybe one person who wasn't a friend of a friend that donated, that just by chance, they knew somebody else that was doing a crowdfunding campaign. And so they looked in Toronto and looked online and saw stuff for food. And they booked a private dinner for them and their friends. And it was, I don't remember if it was $250 or $500. It was a significant amount of money. And it was the only one that came through from somebody unknown. And so if crowdfunding was more known at the time, then probably more people like that would have come up and participated in the project, and it would have made a lot more money than what we did. We still made about $8,000, I think, but about 2 months later is when the first person had this huge Kickstarter campaign and raised $1 million. And from that point, everybody knew what crowdfunding was, and it just became this really popular means of funding kind of startups. And so I was kind of, by that time, I had already plugged through all of my friends and said, I'm only going to do this once. So I wasn't going to do another one now that everybody knew what crowdfunding was. I just came here I did a bioequivalent study in Toronto. You know, there's lots of these medical studies there, creating generic versions of drugs that are already on the market. Nothing strange or flaky that's going to have me grow a third foot. But I did one of those drug studies, got maybe like $2,000, and bought my ticket here and just started working away on the ground, finding ways to do some activities to get started. At the same time, writing, I already worked in international development, so I knew kind of how to do proposal writing. And I wrote lots, obviously, before I got any response. And eventually, Grand Challenges Canada responded. A friend of mine, when I was in Canada, I went to this kind of get-together for people that work in international development. And this guy recommended I apply for funding for Grand Challenges Canada, which I'd never heard of. And they're basically focused the same as Grand Challenges in the U.S., which is a big portion of it is funded through the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Mm-hmm. And they work to kind of create global solutions to health problems that are happening all over the world. And so he sent me the link. I applied the first year, and this was, I think, round six of funding they had a program that was called Global Stars and or Stars in Global Health, something like that. And I applied, I got a message back saying I wasn't qualified to apply because I didn't have a master's degree minimum or a doctorate, and I didn't work in specific scientific fields. And so I wasn't really happy with that. So I wrote directly to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and I just kind of wrote this little letter saying, you know, I think it's great all the work that they're doing around the world to research and find these global health solutions. And it's important to be working with scientists and labs to find the different types of solutions like everybody's doing right now, trying to find a vaccine for coronavirus. But at the same time, they mentioned on their own website that a lot of times it's difficult to get communities around the world, especially in rural areas, to accept the new technologies that they're discovering. And so I suggested, you know, it might be worth considering not working just with scientists who have their main focus in the labs, but also working with people that work in the field who have more experience with impact and influence with communities and can get them to be more willing to try something different. And those people aren't necessarily going to be doctorates or PhD or master's holders, but they know how to deal with people. And so I never heard back from them officially. But the following year and the next round of funding, the parameters changed. And now, up to today, anybody from any country, any age, and any educational background can apply for funding. And so I applied again in the seventh round, and this time I was accepted. And so that is kind of what allowed us to get off the ground and get our pilot project running. The house, they didn't pay for any of that. That's all with loans that I have in Canada still. So we try to do activities. Now that the pilot was finished a few years ago, we try to do activities that kind of help pay for at least the loans, the loan interest on the loans. I'm not actually paying any of it off yet. And then to continue to finish the construction of the home and to subsidize classes for low-income participants. Because when somebody comes from a low-income neighborhood and they want to come to one of the weekly community classes, for example, the regular price is about, let's say right now, maybe about $17 US per person. And that includes the class, all the ingredients, and a full meal afterwards. We all sit together and eat as a family. And for people in low-income neighborhoods, they show me a copy of their statement that they're in a difficult situation, and they pay half. And so that's about $8.50 or something. And that basically is less than what it costs to buy the ingredients. So it's completely subsidized to the other activities we do with other people, including private classes with tourism, including a monthly meal where it's the only time where people can come to eat without necessarily participating in a class. The class is optional, and some people come just for dinner. And it's kind of like a doors closed concept. Where every month it's food from a different country that I've learned to cook. And I said that's about 25 different regions. So it's more than 2 years before we repeat a dinner. And those people, they're really happy to come. And aside from just using local ingredients that we transform into produce and into recipes from different countries, I also have imported ingredients that I brought from my travels. So you get a little bit more authentic flavors and some of the spices and stuff that you can't find here in Colombia. And so those are kind of the activities that we do. We also get donations from time to time to help out with the project. But we're kind of running at the current time. Before this pandemic hit, we started the year off well with some big groups that allow us usually at the beginning of the year to get a lot of the construction stuff done. And we were hoping to finish all of the construction this year and then be fully operational. And then finally next year, start paying off the debt as well. But we managed to make ends meet as far as paying the interest on the loans and paying the electricity, gas, water. I still work 100% as a volunteer. I have no salary. And subsidizing for those that can't afford to pay so that they never feel like they can't participate in the project for lack of funds.
Well, it sounds like you've got everything very, very organized there. I'm curious about your past because, obviously you've got all of this training and you've got all of this this knowledge and know-how that you've brought to Medellin, and this will ensure the longevity of the project, which of course is incredibly important, especially when you talk about the amount of people who are benefiting from this, if only for the family themselves to eat more healthily. Colombian traditional food doesn't tend to be, and if we think about Medellin and the bandeja paisa, it's not the healthiest opportunity to. But I was reading a bit about your bio, and I see that in 2009 you published a book, Not All Men Are Monsters: Sex, Travel, Food, and Life. Tell us a little bit about this. Is this your Eat, Pray, Love?
Yeah, something like that, exactly. That's kind of the idea with those four words there. And at the time when I published the book, I also created a blog. Each one of those words had its own compartment within the blogs. At this time, you couldn't create menus on blogs. They're all individual. It was extremely a lot more simplistic than it is today. So I'd actually create different websites that all linked through one, and it looked like one website. But it's actually multiple sites. And that allowed people, if they weren't interested in the sex blog, to just concentrate on the food one without getting the notifications from the other one or travel or whichever it was. But yeah, basically the book was a compilation of real life story from 2007 to 2009. When I was traveling around in between two volunteer contracts, I saved some money from the food allowances that they gave me in Bangladesh. If I received, let's say, $200 a month for food and transport, I would save half of it. And that allowed me to kind of travel and learn while I was between contracts. And I stayed with locals, so I wasn't paying for hotels or anything like that, and everything was local transport. And yeah, I basically traveled to Asia, Africa, parts of Europe for those 2 years, met a girl in Japan while I was there, while I was traveling, and kind of went through a relationship and a kind of talks about the difficulties. Maybe a lot of people, even today, 11 years later, they're not going to understand what it was like 20 years ago when you basically were just starting to have email and you had like a 1 meg max storage limit on your email. You can even save multiple messages if you had anything connected to those as far as attachments, which was a very different situation than today where you've got unlimited space, clouds all over the place. And then when you start traveling and you want to stay in contact with people, it was just so different than it is today. We didn't have Skype, wasn't as really available as it is today. Other means of just communicating on a regular basis, chatting, WhatsApp, all of these things. So the technology challenges of trying to get to know somebody in a different culture, in a different place, in a different time, while you're moving around and trying to be productive and learn stuff, not just traveling to travel, but actually because you've got an agenda and you want to learn stuff to start my project. Like my project was already thought of in 2003. I was developing the ideas for it. So through all of my experiences and seeing how I could bring all of that stuff together to be able to create a sustainable project that served the community, not just serve my own ideas or ego or whatever else it was. So that book talks a lot about the situation, the relationship and the travels, a lot of reflection back on other relationships I had in the past, talking with different friends about it, and just kind of, it's kind of autobiographical, but at the same time, it's about a certain time and place and what it was like dealing with technology and travel and love and food around the world and people's different perspectives as they kind of impose their beliefs on you as you're traveling between different religions and different spaces and different cultures, and how that affects one's own ability to evaluate what's happening with them at the same time.
Definitely. Well, you know, it seems that over all of this time, since, you know, at the age of 25, getting out of the corporate world, this new lifestyle has definitely suited you. You've clearly, you know, taken to the task in hand and organized yourself to be able to organize projects of this nature. And you were talking earlier about, you know, sort of writing proposals for grants. I mean, that in itself is a particular science. And then getting together these cooking classes and small business management so that people can manage their finances and eat healthily. And then, of course, you're talking about the culture and how we could, you know, when you talked about your book a little bit, it's the culture, the cultural nuances that are so ever present between different countries and, of course, relationships of this kind. And I mean, it's so very fascinating that you should do this, and it's a success story, because I know you're working in with the Via Cocina food train with various travel agencies, and you've got a huge reputation there in Medellin. I've seen the press. So I mean, let's wind this down by saying, well, you know, congratulations on all this, and stay safe, and ensure that you can continue this once the pandemic is, well, I don't know, evolves to such a point that we can actually leave our houses and do stuff again. I mean, I think that's the best way of putting it. I hope that you can start up again from where you were prior to this in March, and that you can continue to, you know, create a benefit for low income families and individuals there in Medellin, and you know, expand the horizons of the project. I guess you've got people that you source your organic food from to be able to help, because it must be all low level grassroots activity that you're involved in. And again, thank you for your time talking to us, Brian. It just sounds incredible, and keep those spirits up.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to add as well, when you're talking about kind of the relationships between different things and where we're coming from, I think that's a big part of the project, as well as that knowing that I come also from a low-income neighborhood in Toronto and Scarborough. I didn't grow up with privilege. I grew up not even having 3 meals a day all the time. So when I grew up, I was looking for all different types of mentoring projects that I could participate in Canada, different means of kind of changing my situation as a as somebody in a low-income neighborhood who wanted to do something better. And so that's kind of the motivation as well behind the project, wherein that helps me feel more comfortable in low-income neighborhoods with people in these types of situations, because I grew up in them. And when I see somebody motivated and I see that they really want to change their situation, I feel that I could connect with them and help them move forward with their goals and where they want to be. And so yeah, it is kind of coming full circle and bringing things back from where I came from and understanding how to move forward.
I like that very much. Now, everyone, you can just put into Google Via Cocina Food Train, and the WordPress site will come up with Brian's project. It's in English and in Spanish. Just scroll down. You'll find the English translations and Spanish as well. And on that page, and of course, we'll have it on the website, on our Facebook page, and I'll put it up on Twitter and so on. You'll find a way. If you have a few dollars spare here and there, they do take donations. You can find out a way in which you can help the Via Cocina Food Train project. Let me take this moment to say thank you very much to Brian Johnston for his time and his generosity in sharing the information that he has and of course that he's learned over the years to create this quite remarkable project there in Medellin. I'm Richard McColl for the Columbia Calling podcast, and this has been episode 336, and a thank you to Brian Johnston for his time. Everyone, stay safe, stay healthy, self-isolate, look after your family, talk to your friends, try and stay sane. We're in this for the long run here in Colombia. I do believe it's the longest quarantine now in the world. You know, we're not coming out of this anytime soon, so we have to look out for one another. That's me signing off this week, episode 336. We'll be back next week with episode 337, talking to someone else with an interest in Colombia or projects or so on, of course, Colombia related. Thank you again for listening. Bye-bye.